President Trump ended the policy of separating immigrant children from their parents seeking asylum at the border, but the fallout continues. Today on Insight, political junkie Ken Rudin weighs in on the ongoing controversy. Are there long-term effects when a child is separated from their parents? A pediatric psychologist joins us to explain how children react. Electronic rock band Right or Die has a show this weekend. We'll revisit their Scream of Consciousness EP. And the Crocker Museum opens a new exhibit on Eduardo Carrillo. We'll talk about his life and work in the Chicano art movement in California. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. The Trump administration spent days arguing that Congress had to act to end its policy of separating immigrant children and parents seeking asylum at the border until another executive order rescinded the policy. The move sent shockwaves through Washington, and the fallout continues this week. Well, here to help us unpack the controversy is political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken joins us from Rochester, New York this morning. Ken, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Beth.
So let's start by talking about the messaging over this issue. The White House tried to blame Democrats for the mess over the policy. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think for the past 17 months, the White House has been blaming the Democrats and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for almost everything they can get their hands on. But this one especially doesn't seem to hold water, because this zero tolerance policy basically is the brainchild of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And so for Jeff Sessions and others in the administration to be defending this policy, the separation of children from their families, and for President Trump to blame the Democrats on this while lauding the policy at the same time and then signing an executive order getting rid of it because he said it was not the proper policy, it just seems like the conflicting information, the conflicting signals you're getting from the White House is not only disrupting American immigration policy, but it's also upsetting Republicans who really don't know which way to go because they're not getting a straight answer from the president.
And members of Congress have been battling over bills to address the situation. Do any of them have a real chance of passing?
Well, that's another good question. I mean, last week there was a more conservative, more restrictive immigration, anti-immigration bill that was put out by Bob Goodlatte, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and that went down to defeat. There's one that was supposed to be voted on last week, but it's going to be postponed to this week. And this is the one that Speaker Paul Ryan and the Republican establishment, the Republican leadership, has been working on for the longest time, that basically would beef up border security. It would put the dreamers, you know, the children who were brought here illegally as children, they would put them on the road to citizenship. But conservatives call that amnesty. So for all the things that the Republicans have been working on to make happen in the issue of immigration policy, that may not pass either. And to complicate everything even further, President Trump, who last week said that I support what the House Republicans are doing 100%, tweeted on Friday that, look, let's stop wasting our time. Republicans should stop wasting their time on immigration. Let's wait to see what happens in November, when supposedly Republicans there will be more House and Senate Republicans elected to office, and then we'll deal with immigration. So, again, the president is not on the same page as the Republicans, because we keep getting different messages from President Trump every other day, it seems.
And you addressed this a little bit, but if you could, just so we're clear, what is the real difference between the immigration bills? What's the top line difference?
The top line difference, of course, is that both of them include more money for President Trump's border wall with Mexico. I mean, that's what they have in common. The other thing, the one that this bill has that the more restrictive bill doesn't have, is the pathway for citizenship for the Dreamers. That also, for example, there is something called the Flores settlement. Basically, it's a 1997 law that limits the amount of time immigrant families could be kept in detention for 20 days. This Republican bill, which is, and this is the part that the president supports, They want to extend the time that these immigrant families could be held in detention beyond 20 days. Now, whether that's constitutional or not, whether judges will go along with it or not is one thing, but that's what this bill seems to want to do. But again, anything that mentions pathway to citizenship for people here illegally, and that's aimed at the Dreamers, conservatives will say this is amnesty. So when you have almost a united Democratic front voting no, and you have conservatives perhaps voting no because it's too lenient, I don't see how this bill passes either. And it's bad. You know, this is Paul Ryan does not like to bring, no party leader wants to bring a bill to the floor that could fail. And this just shows once again that the Republicans are not on the same page on immigration. And when with only a couple of months to go before the election, this is not what the Republicans want to be talking about.
So, Ken, should we talk about the jacket?
You know something? You heard a little hesitation in my voice, and my first instinct was to say, no, why do we have to talk about that? But I think, actually, this fascinates me. This is, of course, we're talking about the Melania Trump going down to Texas to visit some kids in detention centers wearing a jacket that says, I really don't care, do you? This is coming after Donald Trump, President Trump, has been very intemperate, you could say, about how he feels about immigrants. He says we should ship them the hell back. And somehow Melania Trump was going to have the more humane face on the policy by going down and trying to bring her charm and her, you know, or the power of her office to deal with these children, to wear a jacket that says, I really don't care, do you? And then the president says, well, the reason she wore this is because it shows that she doesn't believe the fake news media. It basically negates the whole purpose for her trip to Texas to begin with. So I don't know. It's not been explained. Her office said that's not why she wore the jacket. It's just the jacket was the hashtag that Melania Trump supporters have been using. But it makes no sense to me why in an effort to try to make put on a real more of a human face on all of this, to wear a jacket with such an incendiary message. It makes no sense.
And do we really know?
Again,
what that message meant?
Well, no, I mean, that's exactly it. Her office said it didn't mean anything. It's just a jacket. And Donald Trump said, no, that's because it refers to the fake news media. And Melania Trump knows how dishonest they are. And she no longer cares. That's what the president said. So if that's true, then that it just doesn't seem right to me. It doesn't make sense. And like so many other things, I scratch my head when it's all over and say, what was the purpose of that? So
yeah, there's still a bit of a mystery there. There's some mystery with that. It's strange.
Yeah, there is. I mean, there is, and everybody's trying to read things into it. And I just don't know. I just don't know. And if you're looking for some great insight, so to speak, from me on this, I just don't know what to make of it. It just in the wake of everything else going on, this seemed like a distraction that made less sense than almost anything else we've been seeing.
So let's move along to talk about some of the social media-fueled incidents we saw of protest over the weekend on this policy. One of the more surprising developments was when members of Trump's administration were at restaurants shaming people. Is this the first time we've seen this? Is this unusual?
This is another upsetting development, and I don't know what to make of it, basically. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen this before. Of course, we have seen the president shame people on social media and in rallies and things like that, and mocking people and shaming them. And just the other day, Mike Huckabee, Sarah Huckabee Sanders' father, the former governor of Arkansas, tweeted something, a picture of some menacing-looking, Latino-looking men, gang members, and he said, this is Nancy Pelosi's campaign committee to help the Democrats win back the House. So we kind of expect that kind of stuff from administration or defenders of the administration, but now you're seeing progressives do the thing. They kind of hooted Sarah Huckabee Sanders out of a restaurant in Virginia. Kirsten Nielsen, the Department of Homeland Security administrator, was also hooted and hollered at, mocked when she was at a restaurant. Maxine Waters, the California congresswoman, said that whenever we see members of the administration, we should heckle them. You know, the famous Michelle Obama quote that when they go low, we should go high. Progressives are not learning that issue. And basically, it just brings us all down to the Trump level. And it's kind of disheartening to watch it. But there's such anger out there. And to say that, well, they started it, so therefore we're doing the same thing, that's not a good answer. But I don't know what the good answer to this in such a toxic atmosphere when it comes to politics.
Yeah, toxic is a good word. It's just mean-spirited. I would think there would be a backlash about this.
Well, there are some people who think this could very well help Donald Trump, that if everybody's nasty, then there's no good guys. And then maybe it discourages the progressives from even voting. Whereas Trump could say they're worse than we are because they're doing these terrible tactics. When we know, when all you have to do is listen to the tapes of so many rallies the president has been at that's saying that, you know, let's punch that protester and I'd beat him up or something, and he just says these things that riles up the crowd, incites the crowd, and again, I think when the left does what he's been doing, when they do what Trump has been doing all along, nobody wins.
I'm talking with political junkie Ken Rudin about President Trump's reversal on the policy of separating immigrant children and parents seeking asylum at the border. Ken, it doesn't appear that the Trump administration was expecting this kind of reaction to their zero-tolerance policy. Has this gone according to plan, do you think, or does it seem like they're scrambling?
Oh, absolutely not. Look, I mean, the president will never apologize or admit he's wrong, but the closest we've gotten to that was his executive order. I mean, this is a policy that he defended all along. It's one thing. It's so remarkable. You know, your opening question was, does he blame the Democrats? Does he have any case to make? Well, no, he doesn't. But not only did he blame the Democrats, but at the same time, Jeff Sessions and he said this is a great policy. So which is it? So I kind of think that the outcry, those pictures of the kids separated from their parents crying, and whether they were actual kids being separated from their parents is another matter completely. The pictures have affected people around the world, let alone right in this country. And the last thing the Republicans want to be seen is heartless, again, with just a bunch of months to go before the November 5th elections. So the president did back down. But, you know, we saw this once before. After the Parkland shooting in Florida, President Trump was at a White House conference, and he said, well, you know, we shouldn't fear the NRA. They're bad guys. And everybody said, wow, the president really is getting the message. And basically, he almost, in a sense, diffused the problem, whereas in a few days later, he said good things about the NRA again. So I don't know if the executive order was just to give him some buying time, because certainly his rhetoric has not gone down. He has not backed down on anything. He's talking about deporting people as soon as they get here without any kind of due process. And so, I mean, whatever it is, the Republican Party could pay the price. I mean, of course, the more conservative element of the party says this is a party, this is a nation of laws, and the president is urging people to follow the law. But again, when you see those kind of photographs about these little kids crying around the country, it could only help the Democrats in November.
So let's switch gears, Ken, here, and talk a little bit about the Supreme Court. They have disposed of the last gerrymandering case on their docket this term. They sent it back to the lower court to decide if the plaintiffs had standing. Some people were expecting a bombshell when the court accepted three big redistricting cases. Now they have all turned out to be narrow decisions. So what's your take on this?
You know something, that's a big surprise as well. Everybody was looking forward to the Wisconsin case. This was a case of the Wisconsin State Assembly, where even though the Republicans only won 48% of the vote, they wound up drawing the districts to give themselves an overwhelming majority in the State Assembly. And so Democrats took them to court saying this is an unfair partisan redistricting. And then also in North Carolina, that was last week. And they basically said they sent the bill back to Wisconsin, and saying, well, they don't have the right, they don't have the standing to sue statewide. They have to go district by district. And so everybody said, well, maybe this week's North Carolina decision, where Democrats are also accusing Republicans of unfair partisan redistricting, they thought, well, maybe the North Carolina thing would be a major bombshell in how the court feels about, you know, this gerrymandering. And yet, the court didn't do anything with that either. They also sent it back to the state, to North Carolina, to be relitigated. So, we're holding our breath thinking this is the court is going to really say something one way or the other about, you know, this partisan redistricting. It didn't happen. And so I'm not sure I don't know if there's a message there. I don't know if the Supreme Court plans to do anything about the gerrymandering at all. But right now, two surprises back to back within a week of each other, North Carolina this week, Wisconsin last week. when basically nothing happened. The final result is the court punted, and we didn't get any indication what the court feels about this process.
And of course, we're still waiting to hear something on the Janus case.
We are indeed.
The big union case deciding whether you have to pay dues or you
oh,
don't.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you. The little brain freeze was right there. I think that's the big remaining case for the court. I mean, we're coming down to the final days of the court this term. And, of course, the use of union funds and withholding union funds is a big case. And, of course, we should also point out that it's the primaries tomorrow in several states. Mitt Romney's comeback begins in the Republican primary in Utah, where he's favored to win the seat being given up by Orrin Hatch. Mitt Romney will be interesting to see what kind of Republican he is in the Senate, because we all remember in 2016 he was a very vociferous Trump critic, although he kind of groveled a little bit when he wanted to be Secretary of State. A lot of people are waiting to see what kind of Republican Senator Mitt Romney will be. And just a point of fact, his niece is Ronna Romney McDaniel, who chairs the Republican National Committee. So I don't know how much off the reservation he really will be, although a lot of people think he could become an independent voice.
Always a pleasure, Ken. That's political junkie Ken Rudin. Thank you so much for being on Insight with me this morning, Ken.
Thank you. And next time I'll be prepared for the Janus decision.
Okay. Didn't mean to throw
no.
you.
Well, yeah. I deserve it every now and then. Thanks, Beth.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. The Trump administration's controversial policy of separating children from their immigrant parents at the U.S.-Mexico border raised lots of questions. Parent-child separations can cause long-lasting trauma for young people. Joining Insight to discuss the physiological and psychological responses to trauma is one expert from UC Davis Children's Hospital, Dr. Brandi Lyles. She is a pediatric psychologist with the Child and Adolescent Abuse Resource and Evaluation Center. Dr. Lyles, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Beth.
So how is a traumatic event defined? And could something like child-parent separation fall into this category?
Yeah. So when we want people to think about trauma, we want them to think about the three E's: events, experiences, and effects. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network defines a traumatic event as something frightening, dangerous, violent, or scary that happens to a child. It can pose a threat to the child's life, their bodily integrity, or their psychological integrity. It's important to also think about when things are happening to kids. When their things are happening to their parents, this can also be considered traumatic. If I'm a 3-year-old and my mom is in danger, I'm relying on my mom to feed me, to care for me, to provide me safety. So if she's not safe, then I can also experience a breakdown in my perceived safety as well.
So, for instance, a child that sees his or her mom crying, screaming, being separated, so traumatic. That's an example, perhaps, of something that could have quite an effect on a young child.
Yeah, myself, as well as a lot of other professionals in the field, are very worried about the children who are being separated from their parents at the border. The other important thing to think about is that children rely on their loved ones to help them deal with stressful situations, to help them regulate their emotions, to get through traumatic events. And so if these children are separated from their parents and they're trying to process and trying to understand what's happening to them, this can really exacerbate some of the traumatic symptoms that can occur.
So tell me a little bit about those symptoms and also, you know, the potential traumatic effects, short-term and long-term. What are we going to see in kids that have experienced something like this as they are developing?
Yeah, so this is something that we really need to think about. Kids from the wide age range spectrum can experience traumatic effects. Even our infants, our nonverbal humans, the humans who can't really form structured memories yet, we know because of trauma's effect on the brain and the adrenaline and cortisol that then course through these young people's bodies, that that can have lasting effects even if they don't form specific memories of the trauma. Preschool children will often have developmental regressions. So they may lose their ability to speak or to talk. Kids who may were potty trained before may lose that developmental skill, sleeping through the night, things like that. All of the age ranges can experience anxiety, depressive symptoms, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder. School-age children can have a lot of anxiety and depression when exposed to trauma, and they may have concentration problems, academic problems in the future, avoidance. They don't want to their parent to leave again because they generalize that anxiety and fear of the traumatic event happening. With teenagers, you know, adolescence is such a conflictual stage in general. So adolescents can have a lot of feelings of going crazy. Mm. These feelings might lead to self-destructive behavior, self-harmful behavior, or even suicidal ideations or plans as well.
And they're also, kids are so different, you know. We all have our own personalities. And one child will go spend the night at a million friends' homes, and one child doesn't want to be separated from their parents at all. They want to be home in their own bed. And so you see such a variance in kids and their personalities. So I would imagine this would be the same, too, in terms of how they react, whether you see it or don't, to some kind of trauma like this.
Sure. Some kids are going to externalize a lot of that behavior, right? We're going to see it in temper tantrums and anger outbursts. Other kids are going to internalize this experience, so we may not see all of the underpinnings of what's happening inside of their bodies. I think one important thing to think about is that a lot of these kids have experienced previous trauma, either from their home country of violence or poverty, and then maybe potentially trauma crossing the border and with the immigration. So again, that goes back to the experiences of you're talking about. If this kid has already been exposed to a lot of traumatic events and then they're separated from their parents, that could really lead to some long-lasting effects.
And I think we can relate to this. I can, and in a very simple way. If you maybe when you were a kid, you realize you're in a department store and you're separated from your mom for just a couple of minutes, and that fear that takes over you. I mean, I remember my mom disappearing was like, oh my gosh. And so, and that's just a momentary thing. And of course, she knew where I was. This is a situation that is such a big deal in their lives, and how this would have possibly long-term effects on these kids.
Sure. We can think about as humans any traumatic event. Maybe it was a death in the family or even just something stressful, what we would define as tolerable stress. What do we want to do? We want to contact our loved ones. We want to be close to the people who help us cope with these situations.
So in a care situation, when we do have a new caregiver, how can they help a child recover from such a traumatic event like this?
Yeah, so we talk a lot about trauma-sensitive care. So trauma-sensitive care is thinking about how these events may have affected the child, being able to provide loving, supportive environment, allowing the child to talk about or even play out some of the things that they've been through to help them process that. Also, we want the caregiver to really be helping them with coping strategies to help deal with this toxic stress so that it can re-regulate their systems and their systems can get back to normal. I think the best people to do that are the people the kids already know who love them and care for them and have been stable in their lives.
And what kinds of things could they actually talk to the kids about? Can they say, your mom's going to be back, you'll be with your parents again, it may take a little while? I mean, how do you actually relate to a child who's got a huge question mark in his life?
Yeah, this is really hard because you don't want to give the child inaccurate information as well. We don't know how long some of these children are going to be separated. But I think what's really important is for caregivers to normalize their experience. Of course you feel sad. Of course you feel scared and confused. Any child would, being separated from their parents. And then helping with, again, healthy distraction, healthy coping strategies to help them manage the symptoms that they are having.
So it's just making the child feel safe a key in this situation?
Absolutely. I mean, safety is key. We can't meet any of our other developmental tasks if you don't feel safe.
I'm talking with Dr. Brandi Lyles from UC Davis Children's Hospital. She is a pediatric psychologist with the Child and Adolescent Abuse Resource and Evaluation Center. So let's talk a little bit about that. Can you explain what the care center does?
Sure. So the care center is linked with UC Davis Children's Hospital. We're an outpatient clinic. We serve children from 0 to the age of 21. There's various funding sources. We have a county contract and as well as grants from national agencies to help serve kids. Most of the children we see have been through some type of traumatic event. A lot of the children are either in foster care, are connected to Child Protective Services, or also in probation. We specialize in implementing and training people in evidence-based treatment. So not just giving kids services, but giving kids good quality services that we know from decades of research will decrease some of these symptoms related to the traumatic event. We've been working a lot with sexually exploited youth who have been exploited on the streets or on the internet, and helping them deal and process with some of the things that they've been through. We also have some parent-child programs as well, helping enhance relationships and helping kids with behavioral problems.
So describe a few of the types of trauma, some of the types of trauma. You kind of mentioned a couple things there, but what kinds of cases are you seeing?
Yeah, so we see a lot of kids who've experienced child maltreatment. So if you think about physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and also neglect, we do see kids with medical traumas as well, some kids who have experienced immigration-type traumas, too.
How can physical contact with these young people help their recovery? I would imagine sometimes they might not want physical touch and hugs and all that. So what is the best way? How do you sort all of that out?
Yeah, so physical contact is an interesting thing, because if you've had a child who's been sexually abused, they may generalize all physical contact as not feeling good. Or so we talk a lot about making sure to get consent for little kids, even if you're going to hug them or touch them. Other kids really need that physical affection from their loved ones to help them cope.
So would you actually say to a little kid, can I give you a hug?
Sure. And I would wait for the yes as well.
Absolutely. What impact can a child's physical surroundings have on their recovery, their emotional and mental health, and where they are and who's taking care of them?
Yeah, so we also know from research that programs or settings that are more trauma sensitive in their physical nature as well, light, playful, lots of colors, those type of things can help kids manage some of those symptoms, as well as, again, being around loving, supportive caregivers who are affectionate and really help the kid get through the situation.
And of course, this kind of trauma can take varying times in terms of recovery. So it could take a long time for a young person to get back to some sense of normalcy, right?
Yeah. So, you know, some kids spontaneously recover, but others don't. Others really need some help with evidence-based mental health treatment to be able to get through some of their symptoms. And the good news is we have a lot of really good programs out there, like trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy or parent-child interaction therapy, to help kids and their caregivers recover from these experiences.
And in this situation, how can family, extended family, community help these young people?
Yeah, I think, again, just getting the word out there that these experiences can be traumatizing, and providing safety and stability for the child if they have that opportunity.
And do you have programs that use art and music and that kind of thing to help them?
Sure. So when you're working with kids, you have to be creative, right? So bringing art and music and things into evidence-based practice is really important. But I think the most important thing is giving them education about what they've experienced, giving them some healthy coping strategies and a place to process the things that they've been through.
And making them feel safe.
Making them feel safe.
That is Dr. Brandi Lyles, pediatric psychologist with the Child and Adolescent Abuse Resource and Evaluation Center at UC Davis Children's Hospital. Dr. Lyles, thanks for being on Insight.
Thank you so much, Beth.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Rujak. Electronic rock band Ride or Die spent 2 years writing and recording demos for their Scream of Consciousness EP. Since releasing that record, the band released a video for their song, Alive, in their Tiny Desk Contest submission earlier this spring, and they have two shows to catch this summer. Ride or Die performs at Sophia's Thai Kitchen in Davis this Saturday and at Concerts in the Park on July 27th. Here's Beth Rujak's conversation with Ride or Die guitarist Chris Carricker and bassist Scott Dunbar joined her in studio, and singer Autumn Sky Hall joined by phone. Beth started off by asking Autumn about the band's name.
It was just something that we decided on really quickly, actually. I had it like on a short list of written things, and it kind of solidifies the main theme of what we're doing. Chris and I kind of just wanted to continue writing after both of our prospective projects had, gone their ways. It's a way of supporting each other. You know, this is less like a band and more like a music gang.
How are you describing the music, Chris, to other people?
Oh, it's tough to nail a pinpoint any sort of sound. I would say it's just an electronic rock, kind of almost experimental, but it's got a little bit of a heavier, darker tone to it, with still staying like poppy and melodic.
It's been really fun because we come from so many different backgrounds. Of course, you're familiar with Autumn's background, and then Chris as a DJ, and then I come from the world of classical and jazz music, and then Ray comes from sort of a more rock and like almost metal background. And so the four of us together is really an interesting combination.
I want to play a clip from a song on the EP titled Ghost Hymn.
Ghost Hymn is one of my favorite things that we've created together to date, just musically, sonically, lyrically. It's one of the songs that just ties everything together. It really focuses on and hones in on the vibe and the issue we're talking about, all of us together. Words are so sweet, dripping honey. I got a sway to the rhythm of the joy. Golden hair, cascading down our bodies. We're not ashamed.
That's music from the new band Write or Die, Autumn Sky, Chris Carricker, Scott Dunbar, and Ray Bell. It seems like there's some urgency in there, though. And for you as a musician that's been here a long time, Autumn, and people have known your music since you were in high school at Rio, what is the urgency that's kind of working on you on the inside?
Honestly, I just feel happier in general in everything in my life when I've got some kind of a musical project on the side. I've been doing it since I was a little kid, and it's all I've ever known. It's just what I do. I'm Autumn, and I write songs and I write music, and that's just how my friends and family have always known me, and that's I think everybody else who's a musician can agree. It's just kind of something that's a part of you. And when it's not a part of me, it's a huge difference. I feel really sad, and I don't know why, like, my life doesn't feel fulfilling. And music fills all those mystery parts for me. And so I just keep going.
Autumn, you're taking a page from Kurt Cobain and Nirvana in how you approach the work, at least in kind of that taskmaster side of making music. Will you explain that to me?
That's funny. So I read something in a book when I was a teenager, and I was super obsessed over it. It was like Kurt Cobain, they had four practices a week, like, and like all of my other projects, we had like one, maybe two. And I was like, it's not enough. successful bands have like four practices, maybe more. So we always try and have at least two practices that are just band stuff. And then we have assorted days that, can be more flexible for everyone's schedules. And those are days where like Chris and I will do production. Or we'll do, like, we have a day that's, like, strictly for managerial stuff or to-do lists we have to do. And it's actually kind of nice because everyone splits up duties equally, and we get a lot more done that way.
Are there other benefits from practicing that much, though?
Like, if anything comes up at the last minute, we're never going to have to worry about pulling ourselves together. We're always ready to play, and we're always ready for whatever opportunity pops up. So that's the main thing there. And then also, like, we're very bonded with each other, and I feel like onstage chemistry is a huge part of why you like a band and why you're drawn to a band's performance, and that definitely helps.
Yeah, just staying practice is it's always been something I've tried to stick with, just because pretty much when they see you on stage, you can almost instantly tell almost how much they practice or how they're delivering their product to you. And it's just, I just like to be as consistent as possible. And it's something that's very important to me because I like to come off as like professional and practiced.
We were listening to a song called Virginity. I want to hear a little bit more of that song, and I'll guide everybody to listen to the lyrics too.
That's Write or Die from the Insight Music Special in September 2017. Autumn Sky Hall sings and writes lyrics. Chris Carricker plays the guitar and does electronic production. Scott Dunbar plays bass, and Ray Bell plays drums. They're performing at Sophia's Thai Kitchen in Davis this Saturday and at Concerts in the Park on July 27th. For more information about tickets and videos, check out our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. The current exhibition at Crocker Art Gallery is called Testament of the Spirit, Paintings by Eduardo Carrillo, and it features more than 60 paintings and watercolors, plus a giant mural by the artist who was known for advancing California's Chicano culture. The art is full of symbolism, and its stories are popular with art lovers of all ages and backgrounds. Joining us today is Teresita Terry Romo, a current member of our Sacramento community who was involved with the Chicano art movement and the Royal Chicano Air Force Art Group here in Sacramento. Tere literally wrote the book on Eduardo Carrillo, and she is a former curator at the Mexican Museum in San Francisco. So, Teresita, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Also joining us today is Christina Perea Gilmore. She is a curator for the Crocker Art Gallery. She's here to talk about what it means to being Carrillo's artwork here and how this affords us a great opportunity to connect with important aspects of our California history. Christina, welcome.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk a little bit about the exhibit. Everybody's really excited about this. And tell us first about Eduardo Carrillo. Who was he as an artist?
Well, Eduardo Carrillo was what we call one of the Mexican-American generation artists. And so that meant that he actually got his artistic career and became an artist back in the early 60s. So it's before the Chicano movement. And he, like many other artists, went to art school, UCLA. He studied. He wanted to make a career and also support his family with his art, much like any other artist. But then during the later period of the late 60s and 70s, when the Chicano movement is really flowering and artists become more part of that because they, in a sense, become the voice for the Chicano movement issues, he becomes very involved and then becomes one of the artists that, in a sense, not only paints as a Chicano artist, but then also as a someone who's interested very much in the history and the education, provides opportunities for others to learn about Chicano art and also the Chicano movement as well.
How much time did he spend in Sacramento? And when you look back, do you think that the city influenced him or did he influence the city?
I think it's both. He came here back in 1960. In 1960, he went to Spain, but then he came to Sacramento after he graduated in the late 60s. And he taught here for only a couple of years. He went to University of California, Santa Cruz in 1972. So at that time, though, what was really important is that he not only had the city influence him, but he got to meet Jose Montoya and Esteban Villa of the Royal Chicano Air Force. So they introduced him to a lot of what was going on in the Chicano movement. So it was very reciprocal.
And how has his work impacted the national art scene?
I think I'm very excited about the show coming here because in part of my research for another exhibition that I did, and I included him and wrote a lot about him, he's one of those unique artists that I think anyone coming to the exhibition is going to find something that they can relate to because he very much also influenced by the Western European art movement. So those who are interested in surrealism, in the mannerists, and different kinds of Western European art will see those influences very strongly as his work. But then also those of us of Mexican heritage will see also the influences of his heritage on his work. And he studied a lot about Mexican culture. He did murals. He incorporated a lot of his family and community in a lot of the work. So if you're of Mexican heritage, you're also going to be able to see yourself reflected in that exhibition.
And Christina, why did the Crocker choose to feature this artist like right now? What was behind that?
Well, this exhibition has been in the works for several years now. Most of our exhibitions take a few years to plan. But as at the Crocker, we focus on California artists often. We also have other areas of focus, but that's one of our main areas. And Eduardo is a California artist. But first and foremost, he's a great artist and a very skillful, inspired painter. And I believe his work has been largely overlooked beyond Santa Cruz, where he spent the last decades of his life. We also wanted to call attention to the fact that he did spend some time in Sacramento in the early 70s. He was an assistant professor at Sac State, as Teddy mentioned. And he was, in addition to being a great artist, as Terry mentioned, he was a teacher, a scholar, and a social activist, but I would say from what I've learned, he was a sort of gentle activist, but very effective at bringing people together.
Yeah, and this is a bilingual exhibit, so talk a little bit about the steps you've taken to make this accessible in Spanish as well.
Oh, yes. Well, we had basically a team of translators. So Christina von Henneberg helped us by translating the exhibition catalog, which is a beautiful full-color catalog with images of not just works in the exhibition, but also other works by Eduardo and some other material that provides context. The exhibition labels are all translated, and we had several helpers on those in-house.
Do you have a favorite piece yourself? I'm looking at this beautiful Testament of the Holy Spirit, this, I don't know, so the colors just draw you in.
Yes, I have several favorites, but that is one of them. And as you mentioned, the title of the painting is Testament of the Holy Spirit, and that's where we got the title for the exhibition. The exhibition is Testament of the Spirit. This painting looks like, at first glance, you think, oh, it's a still life. It's a table. There's a dog curled up under the table. But there's so much profound symbolism in it. And your first hint at that, I think, may be the title. Yeah. Testament of the Holy Spirit sounds so lofty and meaningful, and it is. He's referencing a lot of the history of art. There's a lot of symbolism in many of his paintings. Light is one of his areas of focus. He sees that as something transcendent, something spiritual. Same with there's a coiled up rattlesnake on the table that references the Americas, Mexico. There are circles repeated in the painting referencing rebirth, renewal. There's so many things to learn in here. And in addition to that, just the bold, vibrant colors really draw you in.
I'm talking with Tere Romo and Cristina Perea Gilmore about the Eduardo Carrillo exhibit at the Crocker Art Museum. Tere, tell me about particular pieces in this collection that really strike you.
As with Cristina, I have lots of favorites as well and pieces that I feel are very strong. But I actually wrote a lot about Las Tropicanas, which is one of his bigger pieces. It's almost mural size, so it's very dynamic in the sense of its size and also what's going on with it. And very much like in Testament of the Holy Spirit, there's a lot of symbolism in it. So he's drawing on, the elongated figures of Western European art, that what we call, that was referenced a lot by the Mannerists. And then he also draws a lot on pre-conquest. So he's got skeletons and figures like UFOs and pyramids. So there's a lot going on in the piece. But if you stand before it, you can actually see different references that you say, oh, I can see myself in that, or I can reference the, that piece. But I think the colors and the way they shimmer and shine, and he uses a lot of reds and yellows, and there's an iguana that sort of seems to be leaping out of the picture at you because it's much bigger than you would, think an iguana would be. And he's referencing the fact that his family was from northern Baja California, so that desert, reptile was very, for him, symbolic of that. But like I said, there's a lot of symbolism, but I think what captures you is that light and that color that draws you in, and it makes you want to find out more about why did he use that symbol versus another symbol.
Today, do you think that Carrillo would have something to say artistically about what's currently happening at the U.S.-Mexican border?
I think he would. I think Christina's right. He was never the kind of artist that, went out into the streets and actually, walked in protest. But his work was very much about unsettling sort of these ideas of difference within art. Mm-hmm. And he saw art as a way to unify people and to really look and see how it's something that's innate in us, that idea of wanting to speak to others and, share who we are with others. And so that idea of him using the art to do that, especially since, like I said, his family is from Baja California, so definitely grew up in the border region. But he saw that as a region that, reached across and was one region. And so he wanted to educate people and bring them in with this idea that we share different symbols, we share different kinds of art, but yet we're all very much, one people, even if we live on one side of the border or the other.
Well, I hope many people get to see this beautiful exhibit. Thank you both so much. That is Terry Romo and Cristina Pereira Gilmore, curators for the Crocker Museum exhibit on Eduardo Carrillo. Terry and Cristina, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
And I
hope inviting us.
So many people get out to the Crocker to see this beautiful work.
Vibrant. I hope so. The exhibit's open through October 7th.
Yes, Testament of the Spirit. Thank you both for being on Insight.
Thanks again.
That is Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ryak. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.